there was a purpose behind putting these particular designs into these games, and that's what I find offensive. To do that to its a whole generation of children, and just for profit, is something that I think as lawyers, we're there to, I guess, do what we can to ensure that things like this don't happen, and if they begin, to stop them.
Welcome to today's episode of the Injury Pros Podcast. I have a special guest today, the founder of Cordisco and Sale, our senior partner, John Cordisco. And we're going to talk today about video game addiction and what that means and all the cases and what to look for and how you can get involved. So welcome, John.
Glad to be here, Mike.
Finally, we get you on the podcast.
Yeah.
That's pretty remarkable. We've known each other, I believe, for about 12 years. I was trying to count it today.
I'm not counting, but I think you're close.
Something like that. And we started our partnership in 2016, and we've been growing. And but when I first met you, you were handling and interested in some different types of cases. And I know you've done personal injury law for almost 40 years. I know you don't like to brag that long, but you're very good at what you do with our general type of personal injury cases, car accidents, falls, any type of liability type cases. As you were getting more advanced in your career, I think you were getting involved in something what we call mass torts. And most of our listeners probably don't know what a mass tort is. So can you kind of explain what a mass tort is?
Well, most people are familiar with the term class action. So there's a similarity that's there. In these cases, it's a product, in particular. When I first, got involved, it was with vaginal mesh, when I first became familiar with it, I saw just the horrific situation that many women faced with this type of mesh that was implanted with them if they had a hysterectomy or such. And in the beginning, everybody thought this was like the savior. And in the end, it was horrible. Many women had to undergo several surgeries and dealing with this.
Caused a lot of pain.
Tremendous.
And re-surgeries and everything else, right? Yeah.
But what happens is there's so many cases that it can't be handled by an individual, court, like Philadelphia Common Pleas Court, a Bucks County Common Pleas Court. So they create this multi-district situation where, there's a specific district court, federal district court, that will attempt to handle these cases and the volume of these cases. What happens... And originally, when this product, comes to the surface and there's issues regarding its effectiveness or side effects and things of that nature, that cases begin to come in. And when that happens, they try to, at some point, bring them together. So in hopes to try to get some resolution to them, because in mesh, there were hundreds of thousands of cases that this would be impossible to attempt to try with the current court system that we have today. So, as I said, getting involved, I found it interesting and challenging, and I had an opportunity to work with some really talented lawyers across the country, and I felt there was a real calling to do something for the common good. To stop this type of big pharma or corporate activity. So it was satisfying for me personally to be involved at that level.
So these mass tort cases, the way I see it is that they're very similar injuries from one or two products that are manufactured or created by one or two or a small amount of defendants, right?
Well, it really depends, Mike. It depends on the product itself. In this case, if we were talking about video games, there's more than one manufacturer.
Yeah.
So that's just, there are multiple targets as it relates to the situation. In the mesh litigation, there were primarily about five or six, but they were really what we call the big four, those that were the primary targets of the litigation. The issue that you face in this multi-district litigation is... there usually is different levels of injury. In mesh, it could be just having the mesh in your system and, you know, try to determine what you may deal with in the future. Or you may have had, you know, surgery. You may have multiple surgeries. So I guess part of this, you know, the strategy there is to try to classify these as best you can to give women the compensation to deal with this particular issue. In most cases, unfortunately, because of the amount of cases that are involved, you don't feel that many times some of the victims receive adequate compensation. In the what we call one-off, when you do that one particular case, you'll see verdicts coming in as high as $1 billion for one particular case. And people have that expectation. That's the difficulty in trying to communicate to the victim that that's not going to be the case here, because they're going to attempt to settle this without hoping that the corporate entity goes into bankruptcy, which has happened. And therefore, you know, it becomes more problematic in trying to get compensation for these victims. So there are a lot of challenges that are involved, you know, from the, you know, evidence part of the case and proving that this particular product is causing the harm, and then what's the type of harm that it's causing, and how do you try to fairly resolve it in the way of compensation?
So there's a, when you do these one-off cases, like you said, they are usually reserved for the more serious cases, right? Because to take a case against a big company, a big manufacturer, it's going to be very expensive and very difficult to prove. And so they reserve those one-off cases for the most severe cases that I've seen. But what type of work goes into these kind of cases? Do you need experts to prove these cases? How does it work?
Yeah, you definitely need experts to, you know, give their opinions as to, is the product defective? And are the injuries related to the defective element of the product? So it is very, very expensive. Usually what they attempt to do, or the judges attempt to do in these cases, is they'll try maybe 4 to 6 of these cases, 3 maybe from the plaintiff's side, 3 from the defense side, and just see how this plays out. Okay. If, in fact, there are high verdicts that come in these cases, the defendants are more apt to try to get a resolution quickly.
So there'll be a global settlement of sorts, right?
Correct.
And generally, those settlements, when they're global, with meeting with a lot of plaintiffs, they're not as high as some of the verdicts with the one-off cases, as you said, right?
Yeah, there's, in most cases, there's no similarity between the one-off and trying to get a global settlement.
But the client doesn't have to go through all the stress and involvement of going to a trial on serious cases.
That's correct.
So they have some surety that hopefully they're going to be compensated to some degree.
Yeah, the mesh cases were simple from that perspective and showing evidence of harm, because in that case, you had, you know, either their doctors or the hospital records to be able to submit that showed the surgeries actually occurred and the mesh was in fact implanted.
Yeah.
So they weren't as difficult as far as proof issues are concerned. You know, in some other cases, like we're dealing with talc today, they're more a little bit more difficult. You know, a lot of hype is over whether Tylenol is tied to autism.
Yeah.
Those cases were dismissed by the courts for lack of evidence from their experts or to convince the courts that there was a correlation between the two.
One of the more successful ones recently that we've been involved with was Roundup, right?
That's correct.
And Roundup did have a global settlement of sorts, but they are still trying individual ones, I've heard.
There's still some cases, they're outliners, they're still there. But once again, you know, it was tied to usage. So, you know, the cancers that came from the use of that were tied to the usage of Roundup. So there had to be some proof that, in fact, you utilize Roundup for a considerable period of time. The cases that were somewhat, I want to say easier, but from a proof perspective, are those people that were like landscapers and they used it on a daily basis.
Yeah. But that's an example of a mass tort. But today we're here to talk about video game addiction.
Yes.
And It's a new mass tort, and they are litigating these cases at different places across the country. Number one, I believe, is going on in California at this point. But video games have been around for at least 50 years. I'm a couple years, I'll be 50 years old. And, you know, we had video games, Atari when I was a kid, and Nintendo when I got a little bit older. But now the games are different. Now the games are more involved. Can you tell us a little bit about what this video game addiction cases are about?
Well, the idea behind these manufacturer is to get these kids hooked on these games. And the addictive element is really the harm that is a result of these kids playing these games. You know, it's a deceptive design. You know, they don't warn you that, you know, as a parent, what are the harms that come as a result of utilizing it? And obviously, there's a targeted market. You know, these kids are getting bombarded on the, you know, the usage of these games, and now obviously it's mimicking gambling,
yep.
Which unfortunately we don't know what the long-term effect is. Whether it, you know, as you move away from potentially the addiction of video games, you move on to another addiction.
Yeah, like gambling, like you said. So, what types of games are we talking about? You know the names of the games. I know, like, I have three teenagers and they're boys, and they play games like Fortnite. They play Roblox. They play Call of Duty sometimes, and then even play games like FIFA Soccer. And you know, they're playing a couple hours a day max. But you know, these children that do get addicted to the games, are they generally teenagers?
Yeah, it's really all ages. I mean, you know, from 10-year-olds to 25-year-olds. Some of the cases that I've seen that we now obviously represent those claimants, the ages come from pretty much that spectrum. Obviously, much more dangerous to the younger children because it just carries on through, you know, their teenage life, and then potentially into young adulthood. I had a case person called me yesterday and said, you know, she doesn't know what to do. Her son's been playing video games for the last, you know, 10 plus years, and that's what he does all day. And he just can't mentally take himself away from it to do something constructive with his life. And, you know, some folks have said, okay, well, that's the parents' fault, you know, and, you know, it's not necessarily the case. This is more, you know, corporate conduct than it is parental supervision. I mean, your children, I mean, how do you deal with that?
So, you know, I have three boys, two that are 14 that are twins, and a younger boy that's 12. And I fought with my wife for years to keep the game consoles out of the house. And fortunately, I lost that battle because her sister had a game console that she wasn't using anymore. And it came into our house, and I tried to get rid of it, and it came into the house. So it was very difficult because all their friends are playing. And if they can't get a game console, they can play on their phones or they can play on their PCs, their computers. Some of them like PCs better because they move faster. They have better chips and cards that move faster. So the way I see it, it's very difficult to control. The boys meet with their friends on there. So back in our day, we played a game and it wasn't connected to the internet. Now they are playing with their friends on headsets and playing a shooting game or something, which we know has other problems, but they're all talking to each other and playing with each other and fighting as a team on a lot of these games. And I guess, you know, the video game manufacturers know how to trigger their serotonin levels in their brain or stuff to make it more addicting. They have different things in the games. I'm not really aware of all the things because I don't play myself. One of those things I was able to stay away from was gambling and video games, thankfully, in my life. But the boys, they play, and you know, I use it as a reward. So my boys are in sports almost every day. So that's their primary goal, is their grades and their sports. We use it as a kind of a reward. When they're sitting around the house, after they've come home from their practice at night, after their homework, after they take their shower or whatever, it's like an hour before bed, and they play, and it's hard to get them off at night, you know, which kind of leads into the addiction part of it. But when you try to get them off, they don't want to get off. One more game, and it's never that it's never that easy. So it becomes a battle to get them to go to bed. Thankfully, at this point, they haven't shown any of the negative signs of addiction that I could tell yet, you know, which is, I think, depression, anxiety. There's some suicidal kids that you know, that's all they do. Some of them are antisocial. They don't leave their rooms. They don't participate in the things that happen at school, sports, or anything else extracurricular. So, you know, for us, we've kept a close eye on it because I know it can go down a spiral, and the kids will just that'll overcome their life, because the more they play, the more they seem to want to play, and that just falls right into these addiction claims.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned it, because it's one of the, I guess, elements that we're looking at here are the hidden manipulative design tactics that are incorporated into these games, and that's the part that's the failure to warn. I think if parents knew the consequences of allowing their kids to play for 20, 30, 40 hours a week on these games, maybe they would have taken a different approach, but they were hidden. And as a result, they had no idea as to what the long-term effects are. And you're correct. In the cases that we're seeing, you know, there are obviously behavioral issues that are significant. I mean, how old are the boys now?
14, 14, and 12. And to try, it's a battle. No, some parents that maybe not have kids that play games, or parents that kids that have gotten older, they make an argument. Well, that's a parental thing, right? Have you heard that argument before?
Yeah, that's quite a bit.
You're the parent. You should have control of this. Well, to get them off of these games, once they're brought in, you're in a battle with your child. And at some point when they become teenagers, they're going to do whatever the heck they want. Because I know I did when I was a teenager. I listened to my parents.
I don't remember that far back, but go ahead.
But you're now in a battle with your child, who is now going to get angry, maybe get into worse depression, or have other issues that are going to pop out. So now, because of these video games and what they do, you're now fighting your kid every single day. And at some point, you don't want to lose the trust of your child, because you want to be able to supervise them and turn them into good adults. But it's another point of contention in a teenager's life. Now, it's not easy just to say, I'm pulling the cord, which I do. I have the ability to turn off my internet at the house and shuts their games down, which is the ultimate warning. If you're not off, it's bedtime. But you get into a battle, and depending on the personality of your child, they may go crazy. They may throw stuff. They may get angry. And then it's like a whole nother relationship with your child, and then that can spiral into other things. So it's not good.
No, well, it ties right into what are you looking for as an attorney in the way of evidence? And that's pretty much it. You know, we're looking at testimony from the parents, you know, as to how long the children, you know, their children play on these particular games during, let's say, a weekly basis. And what is the effect to the household overall? I mean, we've had some stories where, you know, they're going out to dinner and there's a family, the kids don't want to go because they haven't completed the game. And
yeah,
there's a lot of peer pressure, from what I gather, as relates to this group effort, because if one leaves the group, it could have a negative effect, and then they have to begin this process all over again. And you know, that's pretty difficult for a teenager.
To what I see it as, like, social media is pervasive in all ages at this point, including our ages and, you know, and all different demographics. Now, my kids still participate in some social media. We don't like it, but it's every kid has it at this point. And it's hard to say to your kid no when every other kid has it. Try to monitor it. You try to keep on top of it. But the video games are almost like another social experiment or a social application where the kids are getting together with their friends. So, you know, from a parent's perspective, hand-eye coordination's nice, social ability's nice because you're playing with your friends and all. But when it becomes too much and the child becomes regressed and they don't want to do things, like you said, they don't want to go on trips, they don't want to go to games, they don't want to participate in outdoor activities, which I'm big on, that's when it really becomes a problem. And I think some parents lose their children to some degree, and it spirals. And as they get older, they become more independent, and you lose that control of your child. And then at that point, that's when bad things happen that we see when people are calling our office.
Right. Well, the four primary games that are at issue are the four that you named: Fortnite, Roblox, Call of Duty, and FIFA. They're pretty much the four major targets of this litigation. And when looking at the evidence, I said, besides testimony, any type of clinical evidence where you had to, obviously your child maybe needed counseling. There are some that are really horrific where, as you just briefly touched on, that there's attempted even suicide. That's how far reaching this is. So it is really an epidemic throughout this country. And I'm hoping that as a result of this litigation, that it slows the process down and makes parents a little bit more aware of the situation. So going forward, they can address it hopefully in a very positive way to offset, some of the issues that you're facing today.
Yeah, and like that's one of the great parts about lawsuits. So 2-3 years ago when my kids started playing, when that game console came in our house against my, will, we didn't know that there was addiction issues. We know kids like to play video games, I went to college and fraternity house, kids played games all day, but I don't think they were addictive back then. Now, they're sucked into them. All their friends, it's a social thing. They're all talking to each other. They're all on the same team doing this and that. And then it becomes more and more time and more and more time. And then when you try to intervene as a parent, that's when things go downhill. Then there's trouble in the household. Then they might have more anxiety and it becomes difficult.
Well, as a time went on from when they first started, with the video games, they become much more sophisticated. As I said, there are designed specifically to, manipulate these kids and have them on these games longer than they should be. And there's also a financial element to this thing. I mean, I've actually had a chance to talk to a parent's son. They said, one month when we first started, one of our teenagers asked to use the credit card. It's only going to be $5. Oh, it's not going to be a lot of money. And then they got a bill at the end of the month for about $300. Yeah. And, trying to take the card net away from the child created a whole other set of issues for those particular parents. They had no idea that it would raise, would go to that level.
Oh, yeah. I get hit up for those $10 for this, $10 for that. And again, I use it as a bonus, as a reward structure. I think last winter when I wanted them to start lift weights, you lift that weights 3 days a week, you get $10 each for your game. And it gives them some kind of, they call it skin or some kind of advantage in their game where they get a certain weapon or a certain ability to do something. But it's becoming more and more concerning the more we learn about why the games are now being addictive when we get into the discovery on the case. And like you said, at the very least, now parents like me and any other young parent will kind of, before they bring that console in the house, they will know what to look for. And then hopefully through this litigation process, the gaming companies actually, and now that it's being brought to light, they're going to take away some of these addictive problems, or they're just going to have major lawsuits and it's going to continue forever.
Yeah. I mean, comparable, would you want to say to like the cigarette litigation? Everything was okay. It's, not an issue. And then all of a sudden, decades later, you find out that, okay, there was an issue as it relates to, smoking cigarettes, that people were, do you look at the commercials back in those days? It was a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
Not realizing what nicotine could do to the human body. So, in this particular situation, what the manufacturers actually did was intentional. There was a purpose behind putting these particular designs into these games. And that's what I find offensive. To do that to its, a whole generation of children and, just for profit is something that I think, as lawyers, we're there to, do what we can to ensure that things like this don't happen. And if they begin, to stop them before, as you say, they become, an epidemic.
And protect the future. But okay. So if there is a parent listening to this podcast, and their children most likely play a video game. I have boys, so I can't say for sure how pervasive it is with girls, young girls or teenage girls. I'm sure there's some. But if you're listening to this as a parent, what should you be looking for in your child to actually call us and think that you may have a case? What are the symptoms, or what are the timing, how serious does it need to get before a parent should think about calling a lawyer like us?
Well, I think first you look at the you know, time usage. How much time does your child spend on a video with the video games? And of course, let's just say of a week. I mean, if it's significant, we're talking about 40 hours a week that your child could be on these games.
Especially in the summertime.
Especially in the summertime, yeah. And is there a financial element to it? Because you would have a record of that. This is what we, you know, this is what we spend on a monthly basis that relates to these games. But parental testimony is probably pivotal.
You're also looking for some behavioral changes, though, not just time. Time's one element.
Well, I was going to get to that. Like, if you saw all of a sudden that their interest in sports, outside sports, has diminished. As you said, they're now spending a lot of time at home. They're not socially engaged. They don't want to really do things with the family on a regular basis that would take them outside of the home. Problems during course of vacations. I've talked to people that, you know, they planned a vacation thinking that would be a great thing, and it was even set for the child, and lo and behold, it ended up not being such an enjoyable time spent with the family because of the desire to want to constantly be on the video game, and they don't want to go where there's no internet. So, it changes now. All the, if you think you're going outdoors with your child, if they have issues with video games, it's just not going to happen. So, they're just like, as I said, examples.
What about grades?
I was just going to say, and academically, if you see your child was a pretty good student, let's just say BA student, all of a sudden it's those grades have dropped down to CDs, or maybe even summer school is required. They're not doing their homework. They're just too focused on those video games. And you've seen the difference. And you got records to show, right? You got, let's just say that the child's now in sixth grade, but you had the third, fourth, or fifth grade report card that shows that this is a pretty good student. And now, because of this usage, has dropped off significantly.
And oftentimes, they're playing late in the night, right? Parents can control that by cutting it off at times, but again, you get into a battle with your child. So when they're playing late at night, the school bus still comes at the same time in the morning, right? So oftentimes, especially high school kids, they're going to be exhausted through class, not paying attention, don't care about their grades, lose interest, right? And then other issues come into play when you're not socializing outside of the house or whatever. Anxiety sets in, social anxiety, things like that, which then could lead into depression. They go see the family doctor. Now they're on medication, perhaps. Those are all the signs that parents should be looking for when evaluating whether to call a lawyer.
Yeah, exactly. And then, ironically, the teenager, is grappling with the situation. They have this desire. It's a strong desire. And as you said, as they pull back from, their social world, there's even a greater desire to occupy yourself with the video game. So, it's unfortunate, for the child and for the parents, but, I think that taking this action can only at least change the culture for the future and hopefully give some kind of help to the parents and trying to deal with this situation, because sometimes, obviously, money doesn't solve all problems. But in this case, at least it gives them the option to receive treatment if that's an avenue the parents want to travel.
Yeah, and just, I think, general awareness. Teenagers, they don't really understand addiction, as far as I know. Like adults, if we're addicted to alcohol or a substance, we know what an addiction is. Kids just think, this is how I want to spend my time. This is what I do. Some of them can actually make money playing video games and may have this idea, like a pro athlete, I'm going to be a pro video game player, which is extremely rare, not my understanding, how to make money playing video games, but that's just what they want to do in life. And unfortunately, everything else, especially their education and their social ability, just goes down the drain.
Well, it's a risk reward, the risk of playing the game in order to be a professional
yeah.
at that. And I don't even know what, at that point, what's the consequences of being a professional. I you know, at this juncture in my career and as a grandfather, it's pretty hard for me to put my arms around this, to think that, okay, this is something that's going to be positive long-term.
Yeah, this is it's a new field for us, but at least we're shining the light on it. And if any parents do have any questions, we're always here. Doesn't cost anything. We give free consultations, right?
Yes.
And if we can qualify you through your child to become a client or put you into this litigation, it's not going to cost you anything at all. We welcome questions, and you know, we'll see if we can make it work. And the litigation's still blossoming. It's still going. There hasn't been any settlements yet per se, right?
But no,
they're close
no.
to a few, I heard.
Yeah, they're in discussions, and that's as much as I can talk about at this point. But most importantly, that we need parents to speak up, to stop this corporate behavior, to remove these design tactics within these games, and let these kids be kids.
Yeah, that's it in a nutshell. Well, thanks for coming on today, John.
That's a pleasure. Maybe I'll come back again.
hopefully, people outside of our firm have learned something about this new topic and concerning topic. And most of us have kids, and it's a part of everyday life, just like social media. So thanks for coming on. We'll have you come on again.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you today for listening. If you want to hear more about the Injury Pros podcast, listen to us on any of the podcast platforms or go to injurypros.com.